Hello, and welcome to episode 20 of the History of Yugoslav Football podcast, European Dreams. To this point, club football between nations has been fairly limited when it comes to Yugoslav clubs, outside of regular tours of warmer climes. By the end of this episode, however, that will have changed forever. So far, Yugoslavia's contribution to continental football has been a couple of appearances in the Mitropa Cup prior to war breaking out. Even then, the Yugoslav domestic football was somewhere behind that of the neighbours who also took part in that competition, meant they were soon uninvited, and the competition as a whole was shelved for some considerable time. In fact, between the end of World War II and where we are about to pick our timeline back up at, there was only one edition, in 1951, which featured cup winners Dinamo. Even this was an unofficial edition, and wasn't even called the Mitropa Cup, instead being called the Zentropa Cup, and featured only four sides. Dinamo would finish third of those, losing to Admira Vienne in the semi-finals, but defeating Lazio 2-0 in the third-place playoff. In the meantime, there was European football elsewhere, primarily in the form of the Latin Cup, which, by its very name, suggests who was included: Spain, Portugal, France, and Italy. The format of that competition was odd. While the champions of each nation progressed, it wasn't technically a club competition. Instead, it ran in a four-year cycle, with each federation receiving points based on the performance of the club sent to it, and the hosting of the tournament would rotate between the nations year to year. The result of all this was, perhaps unsurprisingly given how the European Cup began its life, Spanish dominance, the federation getting a big trophy and clubs getting little replicas. The concept of a club competition across the continent to see who was the best of the best was gaining traction, and the success of these smaller tournaments, along with the rapid increase in the practicality of getting transport across Europe, made it a more achievable goal. Along with that, South America had already started its own continental club tournament, which would eventually morph into the Copa Libertadores. It just needed a club-based catalyst, which it got in the winter of 1954, when English champions Wolverhampton Wanderers hosted the Hungarian champions Honved in a friendly. The Honved side contained much of the 1954 World Cup side, including Puskás and Kocsis, and over the preceding year, Wolves had defeated Celtic, Racing Club and Spartak Moscow. Honved was the culmination of a year in which that Wolves side had taken on all comers and swept them aside. Wolves came from 2-0 down to win 3-2, after flooding the pitch over half-time so as to prevent Honved from overrunning Wolves when in possession. Wolves' manager, Stan Cullis, proclaimed his team as the champions of the world. Something which was demonstrably false, given that Svena Zvezda had beaten Honved in the days running up to the game and that, unlike Wolves, they hadn't had to waterlog the pitch to do it. Outside of the UK, the crowing of the English press had irritated one Gabriel Hanot, the editor of L'Équipe, who kick-started the idea of a European Cup, and would lobby UEFA until they finally relented for it to be in place for the 1955-56 season. In the words of Belgrade Sport, "The European football elite can no longer tolerate the verbal terror of haughty Englishmen whose whispers have begun to irritate fiercely." As an entertaining and obvious footnote, England wouldn't even send a team to that first edition after taking the opinion that this European football lark wouldn't last, and that they wouldn't want to damage the commercial integrity of their own domestic competitions by having the champions play midweek. So all that's left for us now in the timeline is to get us to the point where we have a team from Yugoslavia actually going to it. You might, logically enough, assume that the team who would go to the 1955-56 European Cup would be the team that won the league the previous season. Yugoslav football and logic don't always go together, however, and that would not happen. In a sense, that would be no bad thing. The team that won the league that season were Hajduk, in a season that would bring them their last league title before a quite precipitous decline in fortunes over the next decade, and, more immediately, the departure of players, upon the realisation that the Yugoslav FA were never going to let Hajduk be the iconic side of Yugoslavia that the first half of the 1950s suggested they may have deserved to be. That season itself was the peak of Vukaš, as he top scored in the league, ably assisted by Josko Vidasevic and Sula Rebac, and there was little doubt that Hajduk were superior to the rest of the league, finishing 2 points clear but having recorded massive wins over their nearest competitors. BSK in second were beaten 6-2 at Stali Plac, Dinamo in third were hammered 6-0 at Maksimir, which remains the biggest win in any Croatian Eternal Derby, and Sven Zvezda shipped 4 at Stari Plac also. Picked to represent the nation instead of Hajduk were the cup winners Partizan. They had hammered Sven Zvezda in the final 4-1, and, more importantly, as the army team, were the club in the right place politically to be chosen to represent Yugoslavia on that grander stage. As mentioned in episode 17, Hajduk were exactly the sort of side that the authorities didn't want representing Yugoslavia on a wider stage, and they were happy to make clear through their actions that Hajduk didn't represent a politically acceptable face of Yugoslavia. That they were denied the opportunity to represent Yugoslavia in the first European Cup was almost less a reflection of Partizan's establishment links and more a reflection of Hajduk and the Torcidas' status within those same circles. Hajduk could, at least, console themselves with a place in the Mitropa Club, where they would be spanked by Voros Lobogo of Hungary. Hajduk joining the Mitropa Cup wasn't the only Yugoslav side to enter Europe. 1955 also noted the first playing of the Fairs Cup, a quite unreasonably complicated competition that will eventually make way for the UEFA Cup. It was designed to have games that didn't clash with national seasons and to coincide with trade fairs, which meant that the first edition ended up lasting 3 entire years and finished teams from cities rather than actual clubs, as the Yugoslav Cup had prior to World War II. Yugoslavia's entrants were Zagreb, which was a bit of Dinamo and a bit of other sides. Their campaign, due to the spread-out nature of the tournament, didn't actually begin until mid-1956, and in 4 group games, Zagreb failed to score a goal against Milan, which was just the Inter side, and Birmingham, which was just the Birmingham City side. This leaves us with just the European Cup to go, and the 1955-56 season in general. Firstly, coming up from the second league into the first league that season were a side who would not leave the top flight until the very end of Yugoslavia itself. Velez Mostar, with their star striker Mohamed Mujic, who will later gain a large element of infamy when we hit the 1960s. There were a couple of major stories in this season, quite aside from the title race and from Partizan's adventures in Europe. The first was the fall of Hajduk. Last season's champions fell to 12th in the league, finishing only 1 point place and 2 points above the relegation zone as the team began to fall apart. Vladimir Biara had departed for Sivina Zvezda, the goals of Josko Vidasevic dried up and the side became wildly inconsistent. Perhaps best shown from finishing 12th, yet having a goal difference of plus 13. They will compete in the cup final, losing to the other big disappointments of the league season in BSK, who had ended up 10th. The other story was a breakthrough, the debut season of one of Yugoslav's best ever, Dragoslav Šeki Čekularac. At 18, he scored 6-22 in his first season as part of the first team, breaking into the national side by the end of the season. Zvezda would win the league with ease to kickstart one of their most successful periods of all time. Partizan would finish second, dropping away towards the end of the season, while another player would take a bit part role in Zvezda's season, Miljan Miljanic. we will have little cause to mention him again for a little while. But when he returns to our timeline, he will become one of the nation's most important and most divisive footballing figures. However, it's time to go to the European Cup and see just how Partizan will get on. The first season of Europe's premier competition was, as we've seen any time the World Cup had made a debut or return from hiatus, plagued by pullouts. As already mentioned, the English champions Chelsea wouldn't take part because the English FA were having one of their periods of traditional scepticism over any new venture that would eventually take off massively. They would be replaced by Gwardia Warszawa of Poland. The Dutch representatives, who didn't have a proper national league at this point, Holland Sport, would reject it and be replaced by PSV. The same was true of Honved, who would be replaced by Vorarlberg, and also of BK Copenhagen, who would be replaced by AGF Aarhus. Partizan's first hurdle would be Sporting, and on the 4th of September 1955, they would begin the first ever European Cup game in front of 30,000 people in Lisbon. Sporting had finished only third in the Portuguese league the prior season, but had won 7 of the previous 8 seasons, and that legacy was what had earned them their place in the tournament. Stjepan Bobek would fluff his lines in the first minute when through on goal, so the first goalscorer of the European Cup would be Hal Martins after a quarter of an hour. Partizan would also be forced to play out with essentially 10 men, as Branko Zabec suffered a knee injury in the lead-up to that first goal. With substitutions not allowed, Partizan had to shift Zabec out to left-back, where he would face fewer challenges, and it worked. Just before half-time, Miloš Milutinović equalised and then put Partizan in front just after the break. Kim would equalise just before Boek would stick Partizan ahead again with 17 minutes left. Jao Martins would equalise again soon after to finish the game at 3-3. Legendary forward José Travassos would describe Partizan as the best team he had ever faced in Portugal. When taken back to Belgrade for the second leg, Partizan would demolish Sporting 5-2, with Miloš Milutinović scoring 4 times to put Partizan through to face the favourites for the competition, Real Madrid. The two teams met for the first leg at the Bernabeu in front of 105,000 people on Christmas Day 1955. Early, Castagnol found himself alone at the far post to finish off a counter for Real and would double Real's lead on 23 minutes. Gento would make it 3-0 before half-time, with Alfredo Di Stefano rounding the game off with a sharp finish inside the box. Real would travel to Belgrade with a 4-0 advantage for the end of January. This, however, was not quite the full story. Prior to that first leg, General Franco paid a visit to the referee and made things very clear that it would not be permissible for a side from a communist country to actually win a match on Spanish soil. Partizan were not outclassed in the game, which is what the score would suggest, and Miloš Milutinović would have 2 goals disallowed in the first 10 minutes. At a full JNA in January, European football would almost be turned on its head. As is normal in January, Belgrade was under a cover of snow, with the pitch at the JNA similarly snowbound. Real came out in their usual white, which may as well have been camouflage given the conditions, and Partizan handed their backsides to them. Real were unable to deal with the conditions while Partizan were able to play more or less their normal game. Miloš Milutinović scored a double, with Pirvoslav Mihailović scoring in between to put Partizan 3-0 up. In second half injury time, Anton Hercek would crack the bar, but it would finish 3-0 and 4-3 on aggregate. Through skullduggery in Spain, Real Madrid escaped with qualification for the semi-finals on their way to their first European Cup. Perhaps the best sign of how well Partizan did was that as soon as the game was over, Santiago Bernabéu himself went to Milutinovic and offered him a blank cheque to sign for Real. It was, of course, declined, given the relations between Yugoslavia and Spain at the time. As much as Spain wouldn't allow a Yugoslav side to actually win in Spain, Yugoslavia were hardly about to allow one of their players to play there in Spain. The European Cup was, of course, a massive success, and English clubs would join the following season. Real Madrid would, of course, dominate it for the rest of the 1950s. Few knew it at the time, but the landscape of European football had changed forever. Next time on the History of Yugoslav Football podcast, the era of Hajduk is well and truly over, and a new dominance rises from Belgrade. Thank you for listening, and I will see you next time.